Welcome to the Gas Street Podcast. Our vision as a church is to be light for the city.
We really hope you enjoy this message.
Good evening. Welcome. If we've not met before, my name is Rachel. I'm one of the senior pastors here alongside my husband, Tim. And I'm very excited because we are drawing a little mini-series to a close. If you've been following the last couple of weeks, you'll know that Tim spoke 2 weeks ago here at Central on the gift of tongues. And then last week, he spoke on the armor of God. And essentially, this mini-series has been about what it looks like, what it means for us to strengthen ourselves in the Lord. And really, this series kind of acknowledges two things. Number one, we are in a spiritual battle. The Bible makes it really clear we're in a spiritual battle. And if we're in a spiritual battle, then we need spiritual weapons. And if we want to strengthen ourselves spiritually, then we're going to need spiritual tools. And so that's what we've been attempting to do the last couple of weeks, is teach on some of the spiritual tools that are made clear to us in the scriptures that help us in partnership with the Spirit to be strengthened spiritually. And so today, I want to talk about one of those practices that enables us to be spiritually strengthened, and that is the power of fasting. Woo-hoo! Does anyone else feel immediately hungry? Just the word fasting, sort of, it's like a bit like head lice. The minute you start talking about head lice, everyone starts itching their head. Sorry about that. I don't know where that connection came from. And so we're going to open up the scriptures together. We're going to look at Matthew 6, verses 16 to 18. And this is Jesus teaching on fasting. So if you've got a Bible, open it up. Matthew 6, don't worry if you haven't. The words are going to appear up on the screen. So this is Jesus instructing his disciples. He says, "When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face." Basically, you know, look presentable, so that it will not be obvious to others that you're fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. So what is fasting? What is fasting? A couple of definitions that I've stolen that have really helped me grow in my understanding of fasting. I share them with you now. First one, fasting is not eating food in order to feed on the presence of God. Fasting is not eating food in order to feast on the presence of God. Here's another one. Fasting is feasting. Not on food, but on our Lord and doing his will. Another one, fasting is whole body hungering for God. And so as we think about fasting, it's also really helpful to think about what fasting isn't. Fasting isn't a diet. You know, there's a trend that's been around for a little while called the Daniel fast, and it's based on the book of Daniel, when Daniel, instructed by God, restricts his diet in a very simple way. Now, that's potentially a really helpful thing to do if you want to get healthy and maybe lose a bit of weight, but it's not fasting. Fasting isn't a diet. It's going without food for spiritual reasons. The other thing fasting isn't, it isn't a hunger strike. It's not like we say to God, "Right, God, I'm not going to eat until you do the thing that I want you to do." There is a dynamic to fasting that is prayer, which we'll talk about in a moment, but it's not a hunger strike. The other thing fasting isn't is abstinence. Now, abstinence is a really helpful tool in our discipleship journey, and certainly I know I've engaged in abstinence in various forms and ways over the years in my Christian walk, just to help me focus my attention on God. There have been times where I've given up certain things for periods of time, like alcohol, for example, or shopping. There have been times where I've given up buying clothes for a season of time in order to redirect my focus to God or to adjust something that feels a little bit out of whack. I've given up watching TV and social media. I've abstained from those things, again, in order to fix my attention more closely on God. Abstinence is helpful, but it's not fasting. Fasting is not eating food. The other thing we discover about fasting is when we open the scriptures, we discover that there is like a really massive, compelling biblical precedent for fasting. Starting all the way in the Old Testament with Moses, all the way right through to the New Testament with Jesus and the early church. And what we discover is that fasting is synonymous with prayer. Fasting and prayer, they go together, they go hand in hand, and it wouldn't be wrong in some ways to describe fasting as like a type of prayer, a way to pray, another tool, a spiritual tool that enables us to be strengthened in the Lord. And what we discover, again, when we look through the scriptures, is we see a mixture of fasts, some short, some longer. Jesus fasted for 40 days. And we discover all sorts of people through the scriptures who fasted: Moses, David, Elijah, Esther, Daniel, Hannah, Ezra, Nehemiah, Anna, John the Baptist, the disciples, Paul, and Jesus. We also know that Christians have practiced fasting since the church began, right back in the book of Acts. And since then, Christians and the church have practiced regular fasting. And a typical fast, a typical rhythm of fasting for the early church would have been to fast maybe 2 or 3 meals in a row twice a week. That was the norm. That was a typical rhythm of fasting for an early Christian, for somebody part of that early church. And that went on. And sometimes beyond that regular rhythm of fasting, they might do additional fastings, like Lent, for example. We associate Lent with giving different things up, abstinence. But really, the origins of Lent is fasting food from sun up to sundown. In fact, Ramadan, which is engaged by the Muslim community, that actually has its origins in Lent, in the Christian fast of Lent. And it's interesting to me that probably more non-Christians in our city fast regularly than Christians. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? Sometimes what we see in the scriptures, we see people fasting individually. We also see lots of examples of communities fasting together for a particular reason, for a particular breakthrough, again, which we'll come on to. And so the early church, they saw fasting as like a key rhythm, a key part of their rhythms of faith and of prayer. And we see that tradition of having regular rhythms of fasting, it carried on right up until the time of John Wesley in the 18th century. In fact, John Wesley, he wouldn't ordain people into the Methodist church unless he knew that they were fasting twice a week. It's a pretty high bar. But then what happens is we come to the 19th and the 20th century, and not a single book is published on fasting in that time period. From 1861 right through to 1954, not a single book published on fasting. And we can assume it's because a couple of things happened that kind of collided together. First of all, fasting just became so religious. It became this religious activity, so regulated, so legalistic, that it was kind of stripped of its spiritual power, its spiritual benefits. The other thing that happened at the same time is the attitudes began to change towards the denial of anything that the body craved. Around the time of the Enlightenment and the sexual revolution and the teachings of Freud, and a common way of thinking began to take root that not giving the body what it craves was totally alien. In fact, it was unhealthy. It wasn't good for us not to give in to the things that our body craves. And so fasting kind of dropped off the radar. And here's the tension. Here's the kind of elephant in the room, if you like. Statistically, very few Christians fast regularly. In fact, based on one survey that I heard about, only 2% of Christians regularly fast for spiritual reasons. And I say that not to cast any judgment or criticism, but it's interesting, isn't it? This practice, this spiritual practice that Jesus himself taught on, is so rarely observed or practiced by his followers. And that's a tension. And I wonder if there are three main reasons. This isn't a comprehensive list by any means, but I wonder if there are three main reasons why Christians don't fast. Number one, maybe we don't know about it. Maybe we've never been taught on it. We never heard a talk on it. Maybe we've read those passages in the Bible and we've just assumed they're not for us, they're not for now. Maybe we're new to faith. We're exploring faith. We didn't even know that like fasting was a thing for Christians. So number one, maybe we don't know about it. Number two, maybe we don't understand it. And let's face it, on the surface, fasting is really weird. It's really weird. It's totally counterintuitive that we would deny our bodies of the food that it craves, that it needs for a short period of time. Like, why would we do that? What possible connection is there between depriving the body of food for a short period of time and communing with Almighty God? What possible connection could there be? And there might be people here today and you've been following Jesus for a little while and maybe you've considered fasting, but you've not properly understood it, and you've therefore not really seen the point of it. You've not really known how to approach it or why you might do it. Or maybe you've tried fasting occasionally, but it's just not kind of worked, or you've not developed it into a rhythm or a habit. So number one reason Christians don't fast, number one, we don't know about it. Number two, we don't understand it. Number three, we don't like it. Fasting is hard. It is really hard. Bit more on that later, you'll be pleased to know. You know, the other thing is that there might well be, for some of us here, medical or psychological reasons why it's not helpful to fast. And that's important to acknowledge. My hope is that this message doesn't leave you condemned or feeling coerced, but rather that you might feel inspired. You might feel enlightened, and perhaps if you've never tried fasting before, perhaps today you might think, I'm going to give that a go. Or maybe you used to fast and you've kind of forgotten about it. It's like it's left on the shelf. And maybe today you think, you know, I'm going to pick that up again. Or maybe you do fast regularly, but you know that God is calling you to dig deeper into this spiritual practice. My hope, my prayer is that you would feel inspired and enlightened. I also just want to recommend some reading. You've got some homework to do. There's a book that I read on this subject. It's called God's Chosen Fast by Arthur Wallace. Excellent book, really practical. It's not very long. And if you want to learn more about fasting, more than we can cover in the next few minutes, then this is the book for you. I would highly recommend it. Here's the thing with fasting. I love food. Any other foodies in the room? Yes, I love food. I'm the kind of person that plans my next meal while I'm still eating my current one. Anyone else care to admit that they do that? Yes, I love food. I get really excited about good food. I find fasting so hard. In fact, despite the fact that I've been following Jesus for about 20 plus years, I've only been in a regular rhythm of fasting for about 10 plus of those years. And partly that's because for the first 10 years, I was pregnant and nursing a baby a lot. And you shouldn't really fast when you're pregnant or nursing a baby. Partly also I didn't fast because at times during that period, I had a pretty unhealthy relationship with food and my weight. And so fasting just felt like something that would take me into a headspace that I knew wasn't good. And so I had to find a way of journeying through that. But honestly, mostly, the reason that I didn't fast in those first 10 years of really following Jesus is because I couldn't see the point. Mostly I didn't do it because it was too hard. I didn't like it. I struggled to go without one meal, let alone two or three or a longer fast of maybe 3 days or 5 days or beyond that. And so why should we fast? Why should we fast? Do you want the simple answer? The simple answer is we fast because Jesus did it. Because Jesus did it. And if we want the life of the kingdom, if we want the power of the kingdom, then we need to adopt the lifestyle of the king. And Jesus says, follow me. And he outlines for us in Matthew 6, 16, he says, when you fast, you know, as we look at those verses in Matthew 6, it's important to note what Jesus doesn't say. He doesn't say how often, he doesn't say when, he doesn't say how long we should fast. And we can only assume that the reason that he doesn't mention those things is perhaps because they're secondary to what he does say. And what he does say is when you fast. And so the implication is, if you're a disciple of Jesus, you're a follower of Jesus, then fasting is gonna be part of your faith journey. It's gonna be part of your rhythms of prayer. It's also interesting to know that in Matthew 6, Jesus also says, when you give, when you pray. Again, there's an assumption, there's an expectation that if you are a follower of Jesus, you are going to give regularly. You are going to pray regularly and you are going to fast regularly. Now, it's not a command. Your eternal destiny is not based on whether you fast or not. I want to make that clear. And so why fast? Again, Jesus gives us the answer to that. He says, there's a reward. Who loves a reward? I love a reward. But Jesus also says that the reward is unseen. And so something is happening when we fast that we can't necessarily see for ourselves. If you take that a bit further, when we fast, something is happening that we might not necessarily enjoy for ourselves. And so Jesus says, when you fast, and then he goes on to describe all the ways that we're gonna mess it up, that we're gonna make it about ourselves. Because don't we know that human beings have a tendency to make spiritual practices about ourselves, which are intended to be focused on God? I know I do that. I know the danger when I've fasted over the years. I've been tempted to use it as a way of virtue signaling, to let people know around me, you know, I fast. Yeah, that's how holy I am. I fast. Or maybe I use fasting to try and manipulate God. Or maybe I use fasting to try and lose weight. And I become so distracted, not by communing with God, but how many pounds I might lose through the course of my fast. The Message translation of Matthew 6 puts it like this: don't make a production out of it. Essentially, Jesus is saying this practice of denying ourselves physically causes a release spiritually. That's some of what's happening when we fast, that as we deny ourselves physically, something is released spiritually. Something that we do in the physical has an impact in the spiritual. Just take note of this little phrase. A physical action causes a spiritual reaction. And so fasting is not eating, but it's more than not eating. Tim last week was speaking about the armor of God and this idea that there is a spiritual realm. And I know this can sound nuts. It can sound bizarre and peculiar because We're so aware of the physical realm that we exist in, and yet the Bible makes it absolutely clear that there is a spiritual realm that is unseen. But gosh, we need to pay attention to it. It's just so unhelpful if we live out our Christian life totally unaware of what is happening in the spiritual realm, and yet at the same time, we will never fully understand it. Even if we try really, really hard, we are never going to fully understand how the spiritual realm interacts with this earthly realm, this side of heaven. And therefore, it's impossible to try and explain or dissect what happens when we fast, because it's a spiritual activity. And you know, fasting, it's not an equation. It's not a formula. It's mysterious. There's a mystery to it. There is an unquantifiable dynamic to it. It's because it's faith. It's trust. And our faith, it's not transactional, it's relational. It's not religion, it's connection. And so I want to just spend a few moments talking about two ways in which we might fast. Two ways. Now, again, this is not a comprehensive explanation of fasting, but I'm hoping that this framework just gives us something to go on as we think and ponder what it might look like for us to practice fasting. And so those two ways are this. Number one, fasting as a regular rhythm that brings about internal change. Fasting as a regular rhythm that brings about internal change. The second one is this, fasting as a response, maybe a response to a situation or a circumstance that brings about external change. And so just for a moment, let's think about that first one, fasting as a regular rhythm that brings about internal change. Again, this is an oversimplification of something that is a profound mystery. But what we do know, first and foremost, is that fasting is always to God, about God, for His glory. And so when you begin a fast, and I try to do this myself at the beginning of the day or at the beginning of the fast, I say, God, this is for you. I know, because I'm a human being, I'm gonna mess it up along the way. I'm gonna make it about me at various points along this journey. You know that. I know that, but by your grace, God, I choose to say, this is about you. I offer this to you, as imperfect as it's going to be, I offer it to you. And what happens when we fast is we direct our longings up to God. And so our primary motivation when we fast, it's worship. It's to give something to Him because He has showered us with so much good, so much blessing. And like any of these spiritual practices, the danger is to start to think that the power is in the practice itself. But these practices are only there to direct us towards the ultimate power source, which is Almighty God. These practices are there to draw us to Him, to reset the direction of our lives towards Him, to make us more like Him. And so let's look at this, this idea of fasting as a regular rhythm to bring about internal change. When we fast, something internally is changing, not just our digestive systems. Although fasting has become really trendy, hasn't it? Intermittent fasting, because now it's recognized that there are actually physical health benefits to fasting. How about that? And so when we fast, something internally is changing. God's desire for each one of us is that we would know freedom, that we would walk in freedom. And you know, freedom has this kind of missional dynamic to it. Paul in Galatians 5 says, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. There's this missional dynamic. When we are set free, we then play our part in seeing others set free. But there's a tension when we think about freedom, because we live in a world, we live in a culture that has a very different idea about what freedom looks like. sounds like, what it looks like to walk in it. The world would tell us that freedom is having everything that our body craves when it desires it, like sex or food or alcohol or comfort or nice clothes or fast cars. But the Bible says real freedom is actually the opposite. Real freedom is not giving in every time to everything that our bodies desire. Now, that doesn't mean that we punish our bodies. That doesn't mean that we permanently live in a state of abstinence. Again, it might be helpful to choose periods of abstinence from some of those things, but there are also plenty of times where we enjoy these good gifts that God has given us in the right context, in the right season. Paul goes on to say in Galatians 5, he goes on to describe this tension between the flesh and the spirit. And the flesh, it's actually quite a difficult word to translate, but the phrase disordered desires is quite a helpful way to think about it. Essentially, we have these fleshy, disordered desires that want instant gratification. I want it, and I want it now. And so there's this tension between body and soul, if you like. Our body, our flesh, wants to give in to these fleshy desires all of the time. And not all of it is bad stuff. But if we constantly give in to the desires of the flesh, if we feed the flesh, then rather than freedom, what ends up happening is we become a slave to those things. They become the boss of us. And actually, we're not free at all, despite what the world will tell you. And we find ourselves actually battling some of the consequences of what it means to give in to each one of those fleshly cravings. The problem is the desires of the flesh, a lot of the time, feel like our strongest desires. They are often the loudest desires. And yet, the desires of the spirit, those are the deepest desires within us. That desire for communion and connection with God, that is our deepest, strongest desire. And yet so often it is drowned out. It is self-medicated. It is squashed by these other fleshy desires that are so loud and noisy, that are reinforced by the values of the world and the culture around us. Paul says in Romans, I do what I don't want to do and I don't do what I want to do. He also says, again in Galatians, he tells us to crucify the flesh. This is strong language. I love what John Mark Comer says. In fact, John Mark Comer has done some brilliant teaching around fasting. Again, if you want to dig a bit deeper into this topic, I would recommend his teaching. I love how he says it. He says, when we fast, we're picking a fight with the flesh. I love that. You know, when we adopt regular rhythms of fasting, it is resistance to the values of the world, the culture around us. When we adopt regular rhythms of fasting, we are practicing death to the flesh and life to the spirit. When we practice regular rhythms of fasting, this internal change begins to happen. When we engage in fasting, the desires of the flesh just begin to quieten down in order that we would connect and engage with the desires of the spirit. There's something else that happens when we fast, when we don't give in to the body's desire for food. What we become aware of is these other disordered desires, or maybe postures of the heart, or maybe sin patterns, attitudes that begin to bubble to the surface. Now, when I began to fast regularly, I would fast, and I still do, one day a week. And I would have a meal one evening, and then I wouldn't eat again until my evening meal the next day. And so it would get to about 5, 5:30, and I would be hungry. And it was also about the time when our kids, it was the end of the day, they were also a bit hungry, they were also a bit grumpy, and I would find myself getting hangry. And for a while I thought, you know, while the kids are little, I'm not going to fast because, you know, fasting just makes me not a great mum at about 5 p.m. when I'm ready for my dinner. And then I really felt God challenge me on it because I thought I was angry because I was hungry, but I was actually angry because I was angry. And I'd been using some of these other things just to kind of squash it and comfort it and medicate it, when actually I needed to bring it to him. And that's what happens so often when we fast. These things begin to bubble to the surface. When we give the Spirit life, when we give room for the Spirit, the desires within us, we're not surprised then that the Holy Spirit begins to speak and convict and show us what needs to be brought to him. You know, there's another danger with fasting is that we narrow down spiritual experiences to something that makes us feel good, that leaves us on a spiritual high. Anyone else guilty? Obviously not at this church, not especially when Adam and Becca are leading worship, obviously. But I don't know anyone else who's guilty of walking out on a Sunday and saying, oh, I didn't enjoy the worship. I didn't enjoy the, obviously not when Becca and Adam are leading, just to be clear. I didn't enjoy the worship. It didn't do anything for me today. Guess what? It's not for you. It's not for you. It's for him. And yet, we think spiritual experiences should make us feel good. And sometimes, praise God, they really, really do. And that is wonderful. But you know, with fasting, we're not supposed to feel necessarily really, really good. Again, when I fasted regularly, I would expect to feel like this mountaintop experience. When I first started fasting, I thought by lunchtime I'd be floating on a cloud. I thought my face would be glowing with holiness. Actually, by lunchtime, I just felt really, really hungry and slightly annoyed. You know, the thing with fasting, we are supposed to feel discomfort. We're supposed to feel dissatisfaction. We're supposed to feel physical hunger, because guess what? Physical hunger is the spiritual experience, because it directs us towards a spiritual hunger, a deeper hunger, a hunger for more of God, a hunger for more of his kingdom in our lives, a hunger for more of his kingdom here in our city. You know, I know when I first started fasting regularly, what I've recognized over the years is that my prayers have just got really simple when I fast. Every time I feel that hunger pang, which is a lot, I'd be like, God, just make me hungry for you. My body is hungry, but make me hungrier for you. You know, I'd see somebody eating a sandwich and my body would be like, I really want that sandwich. And I'd say, God, I love you more than that sandwich. As much as my body wants that, I love you more. I love you more. My prayers just got quite simple in those times of fasting. God, I'm hungry. My body's hungry, but I'm hungrier to see your kingdom come in this church and in this city and in the lives of the people around me. And that leads us on to this second fast, just for a few moments. And so we fast regularly to see an internal change, but there are also times, in addition to regular fasting, where we fast specifically in response to something that we would see an external change, that we would see breakthrough, that we might get clarity on something, that we might see God move in a particular way at a particular time. I love what Richard Foster says in Celebration of Discipline. He says this: fasting can bring breakthroughs in the spiritual realm that will never happen any other way. Again, it would be pointless to try and dissect what's happening, when we fast in response to something for an external change, because it's a spiritual mystery. It's not a formula. It'd be so nice if it was a formula, but it's not, because it's relationship, because it's a spiritual mystery. And sometimes, you know, and this has been my experience, sometimes I fasted on my own, or I fasted with a group of people for a particular reason, a response to something, and something has shifted. And sometimes nothing has changed. We haven't got the breakthrough that we've wanted. And it's been disappointing. It's been discouraging. We come back to the reality that we are in a spiritual battle and we don't fully understand. Again, Paul tells us our fight is not against flesh and blood. It's against the powers and the principalities, and we don't understand it fully, but we've been given these tools. We've been given these weapons. We cannot see the unseen. But history will show us. I can testify to the fact that when God's people fast, something happens. Something happens. And I end with this. Has anyone seen the movie Dunkirk? Yes. Great movie. And many of you will know the story of Dunkirk, especially if you're taking history GCSE. It's one of those stories that many of us will have heard over the years as it's remembered. And essentially, this evacuation took place on the coastline of Dunkirk. And it was this vital turning point in the Second World War. But what the movie sadly doesn't mention is that after the war, and for years after, Dunkirk was remembered as the miracle of Dunkirk. Winston Churchill, will know, he was leading the country at the time, and it did not look good for Britain at that moment. They'd massively underestimated the force and the artillery of the German army, and at the end of May 1940, almost exactly 85 years ago to the day, there were hundreds and thousands of Allied soldiers literally backed into a corner, completely vulnerable to the enemy. And it seemed completely impossible. The military vessels sent to rescue them either sank in the harbor or they were too big to get to the shore, and the situation looked totally hopeless. And Churchill later confessed that he was preparing for the biggest military defeat. And then on Sunday, the 26th of May, King George VI, who was a man of real faith, he announced a day of prayer, a national day of prayer, and thousands of Christians committed to fast on that day. And actually, churches across the UK, they were overflowing that particular Sunday. In fact, there's a photo of the scenes around Westminster Abbey, people queuing around the block to get into church for this national day of prayer and fasting. And then on May 27th, the scene was set for this massive German advance. On the ground, the Allied troops, they were totally exposed just 10 miles away. But for reasons historians still don't understand, or can't really explain, the German commanders chose to halt the advance on that day, choosing to wait and do the airstrike the following day. And the only explanation we can assume is that the enemy was so convinced of victory. And then the miracle took place on May 28th. While the German squadron was still on the ground at Flanders, out of nowhere, this massive storm rose up and it hit Flanders, making it impossible for the German airstrike to take place. And it gave the Allied troops the opportunity to march on foot to Dunkirk. And then Churchill was aware that there weren't nearly enough boats or vessels to go and evacuate all the soldiers that were now gathered on the beaches of Dunkirk. And so Churchill famously called all civilians who had a boat of any shape, size, that was shipworthy, seaworthy, and he called them to make the voyage across the English Channel, and the nation responded. And get this, despite the storm that was raging up Flanders, the English Channel was eerily calm that day. In fact, it's described as being like glass on that day. And it meant that all those boats, even the smallest ones, could quickly cross and easily get to the troops. You know, they calculated that the best hope is that they might evacuate 30,000 soldiers. On May 28th, when the enemy had stalled, and the weather was abnormally calm over the English Channel and the storm was raging, Flanders, 300,000 men were rescued that day. And it's hard to deny that what happened when God's people fasted didn't have an impact on the events that took place in those days. And I want to end with this. What might happen if this church, if the people of this church committed to fast, to adopt those regular rhythms of fasting that we might become more like him, and that we might fast in response to the spiritual battle? God is on the move. We're hearing stories of God at work in people's lives that we have been praying for years. God is on the move. What might happen if we press in at this time and fast to see more, to see revival, to see awakening spread across this land? I want to challenge you, not condemn you, but challenge you. What might that look like for you? Honestly, I don't really get how fasting works. I've had a stab at it. But I know Jesus. And I know Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And if fasting is good enough for him, then it's good enough for me.
Thanks for listening. To hear more messages like this one, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss out.
If you want to find out more, visit our website, gastreet.org, or follow us on Instagram @gastreetchurch.